This is an interview for the SEC Historical Society's online virtual archive on the history of financial regulation. I'm James Stoker. Today is May 5th, 2011. I'm talking today with Mike Halloran, who served as counselor to the chairman and deputy chief of staff of the SEC from 2006 to 2008. Mike is also a securities lawyer with over 30 years' experience, currently with the firm Haynes & Boone. We're talking today at their office in Washington, D.C. Mike, thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
You're welcome.
Now, you spent much of your early career in California. Were you born there?
Yes, I was born in Berkeley.
Okay, and you grew up there also.
I grew up in Arinda, California, which is right behind the Berkeley Hills.
And you decided to stay close to home for college.
I did. I applied to various Eastern schools, but the scholarships weren't big enough, and Dad said, Berkeley will do. So I went to the Berkeley Engineering School.
Right. Did you originally want to have a career in engineering?
Yes.
Okay. So how did you go from engineering to law?
In my third or fourth year of college, I took a course in speech. And actually, it turned out to be a First Amendment course in which we actually reviewed and argued First Amendment cases before the Supreme Court, which were decided by the Supreme Court. And I became extremely interested in this whole process of case law and so forth, and wound up writing a supplementary paper on it and getting to know the professor who was a lawyer and so forth. And so initially I thought, well, gee, I can be a patent lawyer. You know, I can be a combination of engineering and the law. Mm-hmm. And so that was my initial decision.
Okay. Did you apply to law school while you were still an undergraduate?
I applied to law school after I graduated, and I was working for the telephone company,
Okay. Now
called SBC, but then called Pacific Telephone. And I applied to law school to become I was working as an industrial engineer,
Okay. And
I decided to apply to law school to see whether I could become a patent lawyer.
Okay, so you worked for 1 year after you graduated and then began law school.
Well, it was less than that, maybe 6 months, something like that.
Okay, yeah. And what year did you start law school?
1962.
Okay. And when you went into law school, you were thinking about doing patent law rather than securities law?
That was my initial thought, yes.
Okay. And then how did you decide to switch over to securities?
Well, halfway through law school, and here I was in Berkeley, I sort of discovered Silicon Valley. Now, it wasn't called Silicon Valley then, but I realized that there were a lot of startup companies and high-tech companies, and we didn't even use the word high-tech in those days, and financing going on in Silicon Valley, and I became more and more interested in it, and decided that I could help them write their prospectuses and help them write their private placement memorandums, mm-hmm. because I had an understanding of technology as well as a good ability to write. And that seemed to me to be an interesting career, and so that's how I wound up there.
While you were in law school, did you have any professors that steered you in the direction of securities law?
Yeah, there was one. His name was Dick Jennings, and he was the securities law professor. And he very much stimulated my interest in securities law. And in fact, he made me his TA, or teacher's assistant. So during my third year of law school, I earned a little supplementary income by being the teacher's assistant and pointing out important cases for him to add to his casebook or to his lectures or briefing cases for him to tell the students about, and preparing him for class and that sort of kind of thing. As it turned out, he was elected chairman of the Academic Senate that year. This was during the free speech movement, by the way. It was a very active time at Berkeley. And so it wound up that I had a lot more responsibility during that last year than I thought, and I learned a lot of securities law that year.
What year did you finish?
65.
Okay. And were you recruited by Pillsbury, Madison, and Citro while you were at law school, or did you just send out...
No, actually what happened is Dick Jennings directed me to a friend of his named Graham Sterling in Los Angeles, of all places, who was developing a... venture capital developing stage company, law firm in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles paid more, you understand. And so my wife and I went to Los Angeles out of law school. And I worked there for about a year and a half. But I didn't like Los Angeles. It was too smoggy, things like that. Wanted to get back to the Bay Area, and I came back, and I interviewed some firms, and Pillsbury was one, and I joined Pillsbury in 1967.
Now, at that time, Pillsbury was probably the largest law firm on the West Coast, wasn't it?
It was. It had a grand total of 120 lawyers, and it was the largest law firm on the West Coast.
Right. So after you joined the firm, was there any sort of training, or did they just throw you on cases right away?
They rotated you around for, I think, 4 months to various groups, litigation, securities, et cetera. But it was well determined that before I joined, I would join the securities group, the corporate securities group of the firm.
What sorts of clients did you work on?
Big ones and little ones. For example, I worked on Pacific Bell, which became known as Pacific Telesis, now merged with SBC. I worked on developing stage companies. I filed the incorporation papers for Intel. I represented what we now call venture capitalists, such as Arthur Rock and others who invest in developing stage companies, Menlo Ventures, as well as the companies themselves, which are too numerous to mention.
Do you remember the first IPO that you worked on? Or did you work on IPOs at this time?
Oh, I worked on a lot of IPOs.
Yeah.
The very first one I worked on is hard to tell. It may have been Intel, since it went public so shortly after it was founded. But there were many, many, and I didn't come prepared to give you a list of those.
Right. I was asking because I guess I was interested in getting a general sense of how an IPO at this time might have differed from one today.
To tell you the truth, the IPO then does not differ all that much from the IPO now, to tell you the truth. And I've written a book on it, so I know what I'm talking about. There's this book called Venture Capital and Public Offering Negotiation, which is two volumes. And we published that in 1981, and we've gathered together some of the top IPO and venture capital and developing stage company lawyers. We update it every year. And it all comes down to doing the due diligence and writing a prospectus that hopefully will survive the disclosure test, and talking to the accountants, talking to the management. I mean, that basic hard work you do today, just like you did 30 years ago.
So changes in technology and evolutions in the law have not basically changed that?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, certainly, you know, you have internal control requirements that are new. You file electronically, that's new. You have, you know, a much more elaborate management discussion and analysis that you have to write out, that's new. But the basic core thinking behind all that information is the same, full disclosure. And full disclosures of trends and uncertainties was just as much in our minds in 1966 as it was in 2009 after all these rules were adopted.
Okay. So working at Pillsbury Madison, how long did it take to make partner?
Well, I made partner in 7 years.
Okay.
Let's put it this way, 7 years after I got out of law school. Which I think is perhaps a little bit early, but nevertheless, it's about 7 years. So I became a partner in 1972, is my recollection.
Okay. And you stayed out in California at that time, right, for most of the 70s?
Yeah. In the 70s, I stayed there until the firm decided to open a Washington, D.C. office.
This is in 1979.
And we have these classes of lawyers, you know. It was a big firm, so you had classes of lawyers. So there were seven of us from the same class, you see. And we were, by then, we were partners. And I think there were seven of us left as partners of that class. And I was very much interested in getting the firm on the move and things like that. And so finally, at one lunch that we had a monthly lunch, I said, well, if nobody else will volunteer to go to Washington, D.C., I will, you see. Well, the next thing I know, three senior partners were sitting on my desk asking me if I would agree to go to Washington, D.C., and this happened over the July 4th weekend in 1979. And fortunately, I'm married to a young lady named Gigi who was with the Air Force, and she's used to moving. And she said, fine, and so we literally moved out over Labor Day that year.
And during these years in Washington, you were living full-time out here?
Yes, we lived right in Woodley Park in D.C. for 3.5 years.
Tell me about setting up an office. What does that involve?
Well, I was out here all alone to start off with. I had to rent the space and get the telephones installed, and I had to get myself admitted to the bar in D.C.
Very important.
But then I had to go out and hire people, so I hired lateral partners and associates and others to join the office, and sometimes that was easy and sometimes that was hard. It was easy if it was related directly to our practice. It was harder if we were opening a new practice.
Yeah.
And then about 5 or 6 months later, they sent out one other partner, and then they sent out an associate. So it was a lot of work.
What was the rationale behind having a Washington office? Was it to be close to the SEC?
Yeah, the firm had a lot of federal agency representation of its own clients. Certainly, what I call the green goods agencies were important to the firm, whether it's banking or securities or FDIC and so forth. We represented banks and public companies. But in addition, we had other concerns like the EPA and I remember a big agency was the Department of Energy, and because we represented Chevron, and they had issues before FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and so forth. And then I remember that when I came out, there were gasoline price controls, and there was that whole agency called OHA, the Office of Administrative Hearings and Appeals. And so we had numerous cases on gasoline price fixing before them. Then Reagan came into office after I arrived, and he repealed that entire gasoline price fixing thing. I guess that would have been in January 1981. And so I immediately had five lawyers out of work, which taught me something about Washington, D.C., is that you have to be flexible.
Right. Sometimes regulation is good for business.
Yeah.
Now, during the 1970s and 1980s, you also published a number of articles in addition to other publications. I think the first one that I saw was in 1971. It was an article in St. John's Law Journal about the Wheat Report.
Oh, my goodness, you're going back in history.
Well, it was a while back, but...
I've always liked to write and speak and publish. I mean, you can argue with some ferocity I should have been a professor or a law professor or something.
Well, that was going to be one of my questions for you, is were you thinking about the possibility of teaching law later on in your career?
I considered it several times, but I was a deal junkie. I liked doing deals.
Right.
I liked getting involved in developing stage companies and finding out how they worked, and then getting involved in mergers and acquisitions and public offerings and things like that. And I felt that being a law professor would take me out of that loop, which it probably would. And so I did a lot of writing and speaking on my own. I wrote this little book for my son, who became a lawyer. He's a young lawyer after he graduated from law school, and I had these little sayings on the top of each page of how to be a successful lawyer, if I can be so presumptuous. And one of the sayings is, always write and speak. If nobody else learns, you do. And I've learned a lot just by forcing myself through the writing and speaking mechanism.
Was that part of the rationale for writing a textbook on venture capital and public offerings?
Yes. Because every year we update it, I learn a lot from these other lawyers around the nation about new techniques and new provisions. But in addition, we wrote it because I wanted to give it to younger lawyers to train them. So if a new lawyer came out of law school or whatever and wanted to work in our area, we would just hand them the book and say, go away and read that for 3 weeks and come back and ask a few questions and we'll put you into the in the Corpus Securities Venture Capital Group.
That's good. Yep. Now, at this time, were you already involved with the Board of Trustees at Bolt Hall, or was that later?
That was later. I would say that was in the 80s mm-hmm. and early 90s, is my recollection.
Okay.
So that's when I returned to the West Coast, which I returned in 1983 mm-hmm. to the West Coast.
All right. There's one other thing from the 1980s that I wanted to ask you about. In 1985, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about possible candidates for positions at the SEC as commissioners, and your name was mentioned. Did anyone ever actually speak to you about that?
Yes. Jim Treadway, who was a commissioner, approached me about going on the commission because I'd gotten to know him and several other people in the Reagan administration or on the SEC during my tenure back here. And so they affirmatively asked me if I would serve on the SEC.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand my name made it to what they called a short list. And then Don Regan was appointed chief of staff of the president. And Don Regan cleaned all the financial agency appointments off and put in people he knew. And that's how Ed Fleischman became the SEC. And I didn't. I'm not regretting anything. And Ed's a good friend. I'm just saying that
no, of course not. You were quite young at this point in time.
Well.
So that was.
But that actually didn't happen once. It happened two or three times.
Okay. Yeah.
You'll see my name quoted two or three times, and it shows you that these appointments to these agencies can get political,
mm-hmm.
and you know, you need to have the body politic behind you to achieve one of these appointments.
Right. Now, at this time, did you have much contact with the Congress at all?
Yes. When I was in D.C., I represented, for example, the National Venture Capital Association mm-hmm. in connection with obtaining amendments to the Investment Company Act of 1940 to facilitate venture funds going public. And we adopted Title II to the Investment Company Act of 1940, which has created a thing called a business development company, which operates under a more relaxed regulatory regime, subject to various conditions, than would a regular investment company. And so I got to know a lot of people on the Hill as a result of that major effort. Of course, I got to know more people on the Hill when I was with the SEC, but I'm just telling you what it was like in 79 to 83.
Right. Uh-huh. So in 1990, you left the firm and became the general counsel of Bank of America.
Right.
How did that happen?
Well, it is the most fortuitous event of my career. And I would say I very often question whether I'm really good or I'm lucky. And I remember Tom Clausen of the Bank of America gave a speech on that. He says there's an old Norwegian saying, is it better to be good or lucky? He says the answer is lucky. And I was not really a bank lawyer. I had done maybe a couple of bank acquisitions, but I was more of a mergers and acquisitions corporate securities lawyer. But I had worked a lot with the American Bar Association and their section of business law. And they made me head of the State Regulation of Securities Committee there. And I was heavily involved in the adoption of what's called Regulation D, which is the exemption for private placements. It's a safe harbor, really, for private placements if you meet certain net worth standards and income standards and whatnot. And what I wanted to do was to see if we could get the states to adopt similar regulations to coordinate with the SEC Regulation D, so you could have sort of one uniform private offering exemption system. And as head of the State Regulation and Securities Committee, I propelled that forward. And ultimately we got something like, well, all states have some form of a Regulation D exemption, but let's say 44 to 46 have a complete coordination with the SEC, and I take great pride in having worked on that. Well, this section of business law made it policy to promote this what was called Uniform Limited Offering Exemption, or ULO, by the states. And ULO was supposed to coordinate with Reg D. And they appointed one George Coombe, who was a former chairman of the section, to work with me. Well, George Coombe was the general counsel of Bank of America. In 1990, there was going to be a new chairman of the Bank of America named Dick Rosenberg. And usually new chairmen get to pick their own general counsel or whatever. And George and I were in New Mexico in, I'm sorry, what's the name of the town north of, not Taos, but the one below there.
Oh.
Anyway, and they were having a section council retreat there in January, and we were walking down Canyon Road and together, and he turned to me and he said, "Mike," he says, "I got to retire as general counsel of Bank of America." I said, "George, you seem too young for that." He says, "Well, I'm 65 and, you know, got to retire." He says, "How'd you like the job?" I said, "George, you know, I've never foreclosed on a mortgage. I've never walked into a bank regulator's office. I'm not sure I know enough." He said, "Well, let me send you my 20-page questionnaire after I get back." So sure enough, I get back to San Francisco, and here comes this 20-page questionnaire from George Coombe. And I fill it out, and I send it back to him, and I said, "George, I don't think I'm qualified." I said, you know, all this banking stuff and so forth, but I'm glad to do it. He calls up about a week later and he says, "I want you to interview with the chairman and the seven vice chairmen, one by one." I said, "You do?" He said, "Yeah." So I went over and interviewed with them. It became very apparent what was going on. They wanted to launch the biggest merger and acquisition effort of any major bank in history. And they wanted a merger and acquisition general counsel. And after I interviewed all these guys over a period of 6 weeks, I waited a very silent month, and then they called me over, and they handed me this letter. They said, "If you sign there, you're the general counsel of Bank of America." I was totally blown away. But I was the merger and acquisition general counsel, and that's why they hired me. And I remember talking to Dick Rosenberg, who was my boss, the CEO. I said, "Why did you hire me?" He turned at me and laughed. He says, "Because you're cheaper than Skadden Arps." So, all right, sir.
That's the marketplace for you. Yeah. So you said you already had an idea that they were interested in expanding the bank and undertaking a lot of mergers and acquisitions. At that point in time, did it seem that like it was just going to be on the West Coast, or did it seem like they were looking to go all over the United States?
Most of the mergers were what I call market extension mergers, which means that they were growing from California step by step east. So we acquired Security Pacific, which at that time was the biggest bank merger ever done.
One of your biggest competitors, too, on the West Coast.
Yeah, well, it was failing. And the FDIC and the Fed really wanted us to acquire them. And sometimes we had our doubts whether we should go ahead with the deal, but we went ahead with it. And then we acquired 27 SIC savings and loans. Mm-hmm. We acquired a bank in Hawaii. We acquired a bank in Texas, when we acquired Security Pacific, we were immediately in Oregon and Washington as well. And then in 1995, we acquired Continental Illinois Bank in Illinois, and then we acquired several mortgage servicing and leasing companies throughout the nation. So it's interesting, we even had discussions with Nations Bank in 1995. But those broke down because Hugh McCall didn't want to move out of Charlotte. Didn't want to move the headquarters out of Charlotte.
But then a few years later, Bank of America would merge with Nations Bank.
In 1998.
But this was after you had left the company.
I left in 1996, I guess, at the end of 96.
Were you just ready to go back to private practice?
Well, I took 9 months off. We went to Wyoming and added on to our house there. I did a lot of fly fishing. We traveled around the world and so forth. I have to say that after almost 7 years of merger and acquisition, I was running both the legal department and working directly on the mergers and acquisitions. I was exhausted. And the new chairman said that he wasn't going to be doing any more mergers and acquisitions and stuff like that. And that's what I like, consistent with my deal junkie. kind of status. And so I left, and I got to appoint my director of litigation, who was Jim Rothy, who was from my old firm, Pillsbury, who I'd hired as the new general counsel. Mm-hmm. So I left, and then 9 months later, I joined Pillsbury again.
Mm-hmm. So you must have left Pillsbury on good terms before.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. So when you rejoined Pillsbury, did you come back to D.C., or were you on the West Coast?
I was on the West Coast.
Okay. Yep. And then
I became head of their corporate securities group. Mm-hmm. After I rejoined.
And then in 2000, Pillsbury and Madison merged with Winthrop, Stimson, Putnam, and Roberts.
Yes.
Okay.
I thought it was 2001.
It may have been 2001. I have July 2000 here.
Maybe it is.
I might have the wrong date. But were there any particular cases from these years that stand out in your mind that you worked on? I'm sure there must have been some clients.
What I remember was the bull market in 98, 99, 2000. All these dot-com companies were going public. And so there were innumerable public offerings that we were handling for either on the underwriter side or the issuer side, taking these companies public. Some that don't exist anymore, I'm sorry to say. Some that do. I remember a company called eStamp that... You take a computer and you can print out a stamp to put on your envelope, things like that. And just many other companies that we took public, we were doing them back-to-back during that period. So a lot of IPOs during that period.
Right. Okay. Did you have much contact with the SEC during these years?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Throughout my career, I've had contact with the SEC, usually in the form of representing somebody who's filing for a public offering or is already public and is working out disclosure details with the SEC staff.
Okay.
So I did that. But, of course, my big contact was, two periods of my life when I was in Washington and representing the National Venture Capital Association. I was getting through these amendments to the Investment Company Act, and there were people on the SEC staff who were actually opposed to these relaxations, and I spent a lot of time with them explaining what we were doing and why during that period. So I got to know a lot of people in the what we call the 40X division, or the Division of Investment Management. And the second time was when Bank of America kicked getting sued by Bill Larrack and others. Whenever there was a stock drop, I don't mean just a stock drop in Bank of America stock, I mean a stock drop in some company that we had the temerity to make a loan to, like Seagate or somebody. And when their stock dropped for some reason, then the plaintiff's lawyers would sue not only the company and its officers, but also would sue the bank on the grounds that somewhere in there it was a controlling person or something like that. And so my boss, Dick Rosenberg, became quite annoyed that we were spending all this money defending these suits. And he says, I want you to solve this problem. So I went back to Congress in 1992, I guess, or 93. And who should I meet with but one Chris Cox? And Chris Cox was in the House of Representatives, and as I recall, he was the head of the Security Subcommittee of the House Commerce Committee, I think it was called. And explained our problem, and Chris, like me, he was from a big firm, he was from Latham & Watkins, he understood this stuff very well. He said, Mike, you're too late. He said, the accountants already have their bill. And I looked at the bill, and I said, but it doesn't do a lot for issuers, it does a lot for, accountants and so forth. And he said, well, you're going to have to go back to California and do some fundraising and get some kind of a pack or a constituency or a coalition of a lot of companies who are concerned about this, not just Bank of America. Mm-hmm. So we did. So I went back to California, and we formed this Securities Litigation Reform Coalition. Mm-hmm. And we raised $5 million. It was easy to raise. And the co-head was a guy from Montgomery Securities, Jack Levin, the general counsel of Montgomery Securities. We came back and a lot of attention was paid to us. We worked for 2 to 3 years on this legislation, and met with a lot of senators and a lot of representatives, and got to know Chris Dodd quite well, who was very, very key in the adoption of this legislation.
I think some of the early versions of the bill had very strong language in it. As I read, that they would have applied what they call the English rule to lawsuits, so that if a plaintiff sued is dismissed, that they would also be responsible for the defense's litigation costs, too.
This is a loser pay rule.
Legal fees and so forth.
That never saw the light of day.
Right.
But there were some interesting provisions, like the lead plaintiff provision, which wasn't our idea. It was actually Al D'Amato's idea.
Really?
He put that in there, right, which makes the litigation more efficient. But the most important single provision, or the two most important provisions, are the one that basically says that the court can dismiss all discovery efforts until such time as the plaintiff proves up enough of his case that he can survive a motion to dismiss. Because what would happen is that the plaintiffs would bring down the company to its knees just by inundating it with discovery requests. And that's the second one is the standard of proof, the Cander standard. Is the important part. But in any event, I got to know Chris quite well, a lot of people in the SEC, Arthur Levitt was there, and a lot of people in the Hill. And
did you work closely with the White House on that too?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I went with the White House several times.
Because I think the White House ended up vetoing the bill.
Well, I go over and see Abner Mikva, who was the White House counsel, I guess. And he's a very nice man, former judge, and so forth. Not sure he totally agreed with me. Most litigators did not agree. I mean, I think litigators like litigation. I don't know. And but he did not agree necessarily. But Chris Dodd thought he had a deal with the White House that they would not veto the bill. So we passed it out in 1995. And then, to our surprise, Bill Iraq had dinner with the president, handed him a veto message, and he vetoed it. So I go back to Chris Cox and I say, "Chris, what do we do now, coach?" And he says, "We override the veto." And I said, "Oh, sure." Well, thanks a lot to Chris Dodd, because, the Senate is where that happens a lot. And in the next month, they overrode that veto.
Mm-hmm.
And it became law.
And then the White House dropped its objections to the bill. They didn't try.
Yeah, well, the White House did not really actively oppose the bill at the point where the veto effort was was going on, and so we got it adopted. But what I'm saying is that is what makes fast friends. I mean, Chris Cox and I became fast friends during that litigation reform effort.
All right, Mike, so tell me how you came to join the SEC. You mentioned that you already knew Chris Cox.
Well, I had gotten to know Chris well in the 92 to 95 period when we were working on the Private Securities Litigation Reform Act. And stayed in touch with him for years thereafter. When he was appointed by the president to be chairman of the SEC, he wound up calling various people he knew for help in various areas. So he called Brian Cartwright at Latham to become general counsel, and then he called me up one day and he said, "I'm having trouble finding a chief accountant because some people that we've talked to have conflicts. Can you help me?" And so I called Con Hewitt.
How did you know Con Hewitt?
Con Hewitt was the chief outside accountant with Ernst & Young for Bank of America. And so Con and I spent a lot of time together setting reserves on litigation and things like that.
So this was probably in early 2006?
Yeah. So Chris first got in contact with me in early 2006, maybe January, February, something like that. And so I called him back and I said, "You really need to talk to Con Hewitt." I said, "I think Con will be willing to do it, and he has a wealth of practical experience, and he's been a regulator. He was the banking superintendent of the state of California." And so Chris called Kahn and interviewed him at the Stanford Rector's College that June, and next thing you know, Kahn is chief accountant. And I am convinced to this day that the two of them conspired to get me. As a matter of fact, Kahn says he did. He immediately went into the chairman's office and says, okay, now you got to get Halloran in here. And so I got a call almost immediately after Kahn accepted, I would say in late July, maybe early July, from Chris, asking me if I would become counselor to the chairman. Mm-hmm. And
was there an interview process, or did you just get the job right off the bat?
I had to fly back to Washington, and I had to interview with the chief of staff and a couple of other people, you know.
Okay.
And
so now, tell me a little bit about this position of deputy chief of staff. In organizational terms, are you actually under the chief of staff, or do you work for the commissioner himself?
No, I work for the chairman himself. In other words, my primary title and role was counselor to the chairman. Mm-hmm. And they put out a press release in September, as I recall, describing what I would do. And it said I would advise the chairman on all the matters that relate to the overall investor protection function of the SEC. And so I was like the chairman's chief personal counsel or personal lawyer. And I had a staff of six or seven attorneys who I handpicked who reported to me up on the 10th floor of the SEC near the chairman's office.
Were they people from your firm or from
the... No, they, for the most part, were people that were already with the SEC who I had known as a result of my experiences with the SEC or came from the outside into the SEC. And in one or two cases, I hired some people from the outside. And they were highly qualified people, a number of whom are still at the SEC and have gone to great heights within the SEC. But in addition, toward the end of the process, the chairman said that I also had to take this title called Deputy Chief of Staff. He said, in order to get you paid, because apparently Deputy Chief of Staff is in the pay schedule or something, and whereas Counselor of the Chairman is not a, even though it's something that a lot of people have done, like for example, Jim Doty was Counselor to the Chairman for Breeden.
Right.
And Carrie Dwyer, General Counsel of Schwab, was the counselor to Leavitt. And so it's a well-known position, but apparently it's not in the SES pay grade, so he said you'd be Deputy Chief of Staff, too.
You have to make the structure of the bureaucracy fit the management staff. So.
But what the job turned out to be was that... I mean, you could argue with some ferocity, and I don't want to overdo this because it's not fair to anybody, that I would be sort of second in command of the SEC, particularly when Chris wasn't there. I mean, very much second in command because Chris is, after all, is the chairman. But basically, everything in the commission of a legal nature would come through me. Everything of a administrative nature would come through the chief of staff, who was not a lawyer. His name is Peter Uhlman. And so all of the divisions and offices of the SEC that have a legal dominance, all their stuff would come through me. And in addition, the office of the chief accountant came through me, primarily because of Kahn Hewitt and the chairman. So all these, the division of investment management came through me, the division of corporate finance came through me, trading and markets came through me because of their intensely legal nature.
Okay. Did you have any priorities before going in that you knew that you definitely wanted to work on, any specific issues? Or were you just going to get in and adapt to your environment?
I think the answer to that is no, that I was basically there to serve the chairman.
Right.
And, what he felt I should work on, I would work on. Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the chairman had some priorities. He had been there for
some
time before you joined, and I think he'd already started working on a few major issues. For instance, the issue of executive compensation had already been underway before you joined, right?
That's true. The issue that was thrust in my lap first was this internal controls auditing standard, then called standard number two. And he pulled me into his office shortly after I got there, and he said, I want you and Con Hewitt to basically represent the commission in negotiations with the PCOB to develop a more cost-effective internal controls audit standard.
Did you have any background in accounting issues before this time?
I'm not a trained accountant, but I had spent an awful lot of time preparing public company disclosure documents and working with accountants on those. So over many years, I had imbibed a lot of auditing and accounting standards and so forth that I understood.
And this issue basically concerned what's called Section 404 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act.
That's right.
What was that section all about, and what was the problem with it?
404 A and B were the two most costly provisions of that act. And 404A requires that the company and its internal CFO and accounting staff prepare an assessment of their internal controls and be prepared to publish that. And then 404B says that the accountants then have to look at the management assessment and basically say that they are satisfied with it, if you will. That multiplied by a factor of two or three in some cases or more, the accounting fees that were charged to American Business.
How much money would we be talking about here for these accounting fees that they were having to pay? Was it in the millions?
Of course, yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so you could have a developing stage company whose accounting bill might be $1.2 million, and all of a sudden it would be $4 million. As a result of this.
Now, some of these were relatively small cap companies.
Yes. Now, what we learned is that the accounting fees were high during the first two or three years as they were implementing all the controls. And then they would tend to level off a bit. They were still high after that. But what we also learned is that there were many, many things that auditors were looking at that were neither really risk-based nor material, the M words, material. And that, therefore, they were looking at all sorts of perceived control functions, which even if it got out of control, wouldn't materially affect the financial statements. There wasn't a material risk, you see what I mean? So the mission of our chairman and us was to try to get the accounting standard to focus on that which was risky and material, if you will. And
to do that, you had to interface with the PCAOB.
Very much so, yeah. And all the PCAOB board members and their staff. And it became somewhat political, very political, in the sense that a number of institutional investors, particularly union pension funds, opposed the effort and voiced their views vigorously.
What was their objection? Did they think that it would just undermine the internal controls?
Right. That undermining internal controls puts America at risk and puts the financial statements at risk. And
where were the accounting firms on the issue?
They also were in favor of leaving things the way they were. But you know, people say it so the accounting firms could make a lot of money. I actually don't agree with that. I think it's because the accounting firms were trying to protect themselves from liability. I mean, believe me, there had been lawsuits and settlements which were very meaningful to a lot of firms, and I think they felt this internal control function was necessary to protect them, which I think is an honorable reason to oppose it. But nevertheless, the overall costs on American Business far outweighed the benefits.
Okay. And, of course, this was just 4 years after the Enron collapse, so that was very much in everyone's mind.
Yeah. And WorldCom and so forth.
Right.
And so we worked on that, and you know, I could spend another hour detailing the changes that were made. But I might add that we were aided greatly in this effort by the small business committees on both sides of Congress, who supported the effort. And they would hold hearings periodically demanding where we were and where we were going to solve this problem, because they were getting noise from their small business constituency that this was costing too much. And so what we hope we arrived at was sort of a scaling standard where if you were smaller, the amount of internal control effort would be scaled down for you. It's not 100% clear, but it's pretty clear that that's what you're supposed to do. And in any event, it got adopted in, let's say, June of 2007, and I count that as a major accomplishment. And I am told by several people, like my good friend John Olson at Gibson Dunn and others who represent public companies, that the amount of savings and cost savings has far outstripped the what was originally predicted of 10 to 15%, that it's sometimes as much as 40% in terms of the overall cost, without giving up control of the internal control function. In other words, you're sort of loosening controls by focusing on what's risky and what's material without losing control. Do you see what I mean? And that's an important concept.
Right. But in order to get to this result, in early 2007, the SEC actually had to vote to repeal the PCAOB's interpretation of Section 404. Now, the SEC is stepping in here. What does that say to you? I mean, why was that necessary? Does it indicate that the board is not functioning correctly?
Okay. At what point in time is this, are you referring to?
In 2007, when the SEC voted to repeal the PCAOB's interpretation of Section 404, or to instruct it to come up with a new interpretation. So it changed from 2 to 5.
I think it's fair to say that the PCAOB didn't really want to do this. And it's a credit to Chris Cox and to Congress that they did want them to do it. And after considerable discussion, sometimes heated, we got together and spent untold hours in untold conference rooms with leaks in the Wall Street Journal and so forth, and, you know, coming up with something which was a compromise between us and the PCAOB, which I think is very workable.
Okay. So, did the Bush administration express an opinion on this issue at all?
The answer is I don't recall, which seems funny. You think they would, but I just don't recall. We had very little contact with the Bush administration. By the Bush administration, if you mean the White House,
right?
We had very little contact with the White House. They didn't call up and give us orders or anything. That, by the way, is different from Congress, where you get a call from Jack Schumer or somebody about some issue with the New York Stock Exchange or some investment banker. But the White House, I think, was very careful not to to try to, you know, push the agency around and so forth. So. I'm sure the White House probably made statements regarding the costliness of Sarbanes-Oxley, but we received no instructions, so to speak, on that matter.
Okay. Let's talk about a couple of other issues. First of all, the new public offering rules at the SEC, I guess they weren't adopted in 2006, but they went into force in 2006. There were a new set of rules governing IPOs that liberalized the rules for shelf registration statements and things like that. Was this an issue that you worked on?
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
I mean, one thing we did was there was this Form S-2 for small business issuers. We collapsed all that into Form S-1 and then broadened it to cover more issuers. More small companies could use the reduced effort to reduce disclosure standards of a small business issuer under Form S-1, and that was one of the things we accomplished.
Okay. And the goal of that was just to reduce paperwork and to reduce expenses for the businesses.
We adopted a whole package of reforms or proposals for small business, one of which was the changes in Rule 144.
Tell me about that.
And Rule 144, as you know, is the rule by which affiliates sell securities into the public markets. And or holders of restricted stock sell securities in the public markets after a holding period and things like that. And we reduced the holding period to a year for non-public companies and 6 months for public companies. And in addition, and this is something I take personal credit for, there was a problem with the hoary concept called the integration doctrine. The integration doctrine says that if you're doing a private placement and a public offering at the same time, you have to register the private placement too, because you're doing it at the same time, you see what I mean? Which can be very expensive for the private placement. Or the public offering may not be registered yet, it may just be going on in registration, which impeded the ability of companies who were running out of capital to raise capital when they were in the filing process. And we got that fixed, pretty much, and that's something I pushed very hard, so that companies could actually raise capital from accredited investors during the public offering. And that interpretation was part of this package of releases that we put out.
Okay, good. Let's also talk a little bit about the SEC's role in overseeing investment banks. So in 2004, there were some big changes in the regulations of the largest investment banks. I think there was an agreement that exempted the five largest banks from the net capital rule. And at the same time, there was also an agreement that the SEC would oversee at least part of what were called consolidated supervised entities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Where did this issue stand when you joined the SEC?
Well, by the time I joined the SEC, five big investment banks were subject to the consolidated supervised entity regulatory regime. They did this by consenting mm-hmm. to be regulated. Which meant that they were regulated for the first time at the holding company level and not just at the subsidiary broker-dealer level.
Right. Was the SEC ready to do that? Did it have the staff to do that?
I would say on balance that the SEC definitely needed more staff to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big, complex task with big, complex firms, you know. And on reflection, the SEC needed more staff. When I came to the SEC, this was not something on which I had worked or knew a whole lot about. And so I found out about it shortly after I arrived. I said, that's interesting. You know, tell me how this works. And I had a guy on my staff, Jim Eastman, who had come out of the trading and markets division, and he was one of my counsel, and he explained it to me, you know, how it worked. And he explained that the European regulators had wanted all these investment banks to be regulated by all the European regulators, which they didn't want because it resulted in multiple leverage regulation and so forth. So the European regulators said, okay, if you become a consolidated supervised entity under some responsible U.S. regulator, we won't regulate you. So they marched into the SEC and asked for regulation, and they got it, and they consented to it. That's why this happened. And
who within the SEC was in charge of doing that regulation? Was there a specific office, or maybe the Office of Risk Assessment?
Well, no, it's the Division of Trading and Markets.
Okay.
I think at that time it was called Market Regulation, mm-hmm. Headed up by Eric Seary, and then he had a division within Trading and Markets whose responsibility was to regulate the consolidated supervised entities.
Okay. Yeah.
Run by a guy named Matt Eichner. Matt Eichner ran that.
All right. All right, we'll come back to this here in a couple of minutes when we talk about the financial crisis. First, I'd also like to ask you about the creation of FINRA. I don't know if you worked on that issue at all.
Yes. I mean, in one sense, FINRA is simply a name, mm-hmm. a new name for the NASD. In another sense, it's a new structure, a new organization, because it took over the regulatory function from the New York Stock Exchange.
Right. Where was that at when you joined the SEC?
I believe that was in process of being changed over as I joined the SEC.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And Mary Shapiro, who was head of the NASD / FINRA, in a sense, sort of reported to me to the chairman, and she and I had several discussions regarding FINRA and, you know, the difficulties they were having getting the small brokers to agree to the whole restructuring of FINRA and the takeover of the market rank function of the New York Stock Exchange and so forth. And I was impressed by her. I was very impressed. And, but in any event, she would often talk to me about things they were concerned about.
Okay. And hedge fund regulation. Now, hedge funds, industry, of course, have long resisted regulation. And then in 2006, the courts had struck down a 2004 rule left over from the Donaldson years that would have required the registration of hedge funds for or that had 15 or more clients. Now, under the Cox chairmanship, the SEC didn't appeal this decision. Was there any talk of the possibility of trying to pass a new rule that would have required hedge funds to register?
Yes, there was.
Yeah.
The decision was made that to try to adopt a new rule would probably be struck down again. So we didn't want to do that. But the Goldstein decision, which is the decision you're talking about, did give us a guideline for how to take care of at least the fraud aspects of hedge fund regulation. And they said that if you go under Section 204, sub 4, I think it is, you know, that's a rule that is not focused on the word client, okay, so that you could adopt rules, anti-fraud rules under that, which relate to hedge funds, and we did. And again, I was given a leadership role in that because I understood, I've done a lot of fund work over my career, I understood it pretty much implicitly. And so I worked extensively with the Division of Investment Management to adopt this hedge fund anti-fraud rule, but it applies to a lot more than hedge funds. It applies to all funds in this country who are in a pooled investment form, including venture funds, including, you know, private equity funds. And so
I understand there was also a hedge fund working group within the Division of Enforcement.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Did you bring any suits against hedge funds during these years, as you recall?
Yes. But they primarily had to do with either insider trading or market manipulation.
Okay. And just bring up information technology. That was also a big issue under the Cox chairmanship. Was this something that you worked on, or was
very actively?
Okay.
And again, the chairman thought I must know something about this, being from Silicon Valley. And I was interested in it, as was Con Hewitt. And the chairman was very much an interactive technology chairman. And pretty soon, I became familiar with something called XBRL. Extensible business reporting language, and the idea of being able to go in and actually manipulate the figures on file by a public company to show them the way you want them or to compare them with other companies sounded really neat to me. So I got very actively involved with an outside agency called XBRL US and their people, and we worked over a period of 2 years very actively promoting the standard and developing the tags.
Is that a private company or a nonprofit?
It's a nonprofit.
Okay.
It's a private organization. There's a comparable parent organization based in London, I think. But I worked with the people in that organization because we were, in effect, funding a lot of their work. And so we had a lot to say about how it went. And we set goals and timelines and so forth for the adoption of the what's called the taxonomy. Mm-hmm. Which is a series of tags that you have to adopt, whether it's income or revenues or expenses or whatever. You have to tag all these items so that you can put the figure in and then manipulate it. Mm-hmm. And it was a lot of work in, I thought, a short period of time. And then we had to decide how to roll it out on American business.
Was that something that the American business seemed interested in? And did you have companies contacting you about that, or was it something sort of abstract that they didn't?
Yeah, they were. It wasn't the most important thing to them, but they were interested in it. And we asked for volunteers to come forth and voluntarily file under XBRL just to see how it would work. So we got Microsoft and 40 other American companies to do the work to voluntarily file so we could work the bugs out of the system with the big companies.
Was this something that over the long run was probably going to increase costs for them or decrease them? Or would it have any effect on it? Because I'm just wondering, if it costs so much money to implement the different accounting measures and auditing measures, how much the
I think it would increase costs.
Yeah.
It also increases disclosure. Don't forget that they still have to file in paper. Now, when I say file in paper, that's not really true. They file electronically, but they file under the regular EDGAR electronic system. Now they have to also file under the XBRL system. Mm-hmm. You'd have to agree that it does increase costs, but I think it increases transparency too.
You just mentioned the EDGAR system, which has been around since the 1980s. In 2008, the SEC also unveiled a successor to the EDGAR system, the IDEA system. Did you work on that also?
Yes.
What was involved in that?
The IDEA system was really a combination of both EDGAR and XBRL. It was a combination of both. But then it was supposed to lateral out to a new system of disclosure where we would basically go through all the rules and try to get rid of all the ones that were outdated and update the ones that were outdated and so forth, and then try to plug those into the electronic system. And as I was leaving, that task force was being set up.
Okay. All right, let's talk a little bit about the enforcement work of the commission. Tell me about your role in supervising enforcement cases while you were at the SEC. Did every case come through you?
Yes.
That must have been quite a few.
Yes. I'll never forget that the chairman and Peter Uhlman, chief of staff, called me into the office and they said, "And you are going to be in charge of all the enforcement cases coming through." And I kind of looked at him and said, "I am." They said, "Well, you're the lawyer." I said, "Okay." And so what would happen is that Linda Thompson would meet with me once or twice a week along with Peter Bresnan and Walter Ricciardi and her chief people. Mm-hmm. And we would go over the main cases, particularly the cases that might be controversial. We would try to give them some guidance, regarding where we wanted to go and where we didn't. And
if the enforcement staff wanted to settle a case before taking it to court or after taking it to court, did they have to go through the commission first?
Yes. Okay. They still do.
Right. And how did that, how did that system work? Did they just come to you and make proposals, and then you approved it, give it a thumbs up?
Well, when I got there, they would negotiate with the company. Let's say it's a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act violation, and they'd have the company pay $40 million as a penalty or disgorgement or something for the violation. And they would write it up in a memo, and they'd present this to the commission, and the commission could either approve or disapprove, and it would come through me. And we could say, we think that's too much or too little or whatever. And theoretically, the commission could send them back to the negotiating table if they didn't like the number.
Are there any major cases from this period that stand out in your mind? Or
you mean just generally or in the...
Well, in general, I mean, over the years, what you care to talk about?
Well... we were there during the stock option backdating case era. This backdating had taken place before I got there, but the cases were all there when I was there. And so I would say we brought at least 30 or 40 of them while I was there. Mm-hmm. And so I very much remember the stock option backdating cases. And
you also worked on some Supreme Court briefs during this period, right?
I did. There's two I remember in particular. There were more, but one was Stoneridge, the Stoneridge case. which has to do with secondary actor liability under the anti-fraud provisions of the federal securities law.
As Section 10B and
Rule
10B-5.
It involved Motorola and a company called Charter Communications, as I recall, where Charter Communications was trying to increase its revenues. So it got Motorola to agree, I guess, to increase the price for the equipment it was selling to Charter Communications. And then that increase was used to buy advertising on its TV stations. And so you, in effect, were increasing Charter Communications' income, because on a capital investment, the equipment, you don't write that off immediately. And
so what position did the SEC take on this? Did they argue that they should have been liable or should not have been liable?
Well, clearly Charter Communications should be liable. It cooked its own books, and clearly its executives should be liable.
But the third party, no.
But the question was, should Motorola be liable? And the position that I took, and which other people took, was that unless the investing public thought it was relying on Motorola, in other words, its name was in the prospectus or something, that it could not hold Motorola liable for this. We're talking now about billions of dollars of liability, okay? And that if it were otherwise, then you would have a situation where banks, investment banks, and other people who are involved in structuring deals could be potentially liable for billions of dollars by virtue of having helped a company structure a deal. Now, you may not like that answer or like that result, but I didn't feel the 10b-5 was built for that kind of secondary liability, where unless the investor was relying upon, or unless Motorola was a controlling person over Charter Communications, which it wasn't. It was just a vendor.
Did the SEC agree with the brief?
I'm sorry,
the Supreme Court agreed with the brief.
Supreme Court agreed with, quote, my position.
Right.
Okay. However, the Solicitor General didn't. And The Solicitor General agreed with that position. Okay. But there was considerable press on this issue, and the SEC was not helping investors out, and so the SEC adopted sort of a compromise position in the briefs before the Supreme Court, which I can get into in some detail.
Right.
But it was sort of a compromise position on the overall issue. But the Supreme Court, by and large, adopted the Stone Ridge decision, which to this day has resulted in relief of secondary actors from 10b-5 liability. They might be liable for common fraud liability, but that's a different issue.
The lawyers out there can go and look at the documents if they want to see the specific arguments.
Right.
Okay. Now, maybe the biggest criticism of enforcement at the SEC during these years is that they seem to have missed the Bernie Madoff scandal. Was Bernie Madoff on the radar at all?
No. I didn't know who Bernie Madoff was. Chris Cox didn't know who Bernie Madoff was. I don't think any of the commissioners even knew who he was. I mean, he never entered the SEC as far as I knew.
No, he was big at the NASD. I think he was important.
I guess so.
I don't think that
he somehow managed to slip under the radar of five different chairmen of the SEC. And it's just too bad that he, shall we say, turned state's evidence in the last month of Chris's administration. It's just too bad that that happened. But the Inspector General's report is fairly damning of the SEC enforcement staff, particularly in New York, over their failure to pick up on his fraud.
All right, well, let's talk about the financial crisis a little bit. Do you remember the first moment when you realized that there was probably going to be a financial crisis and that it was going to be a big one?
Yes. In November of 2006, some reports from the Fed across my desk, and these are monthly reports on mortgage foreclosures and other data. And being a former banker, I looked at that stuff. I thought it was interesting. And I opened up the page, and it said subprime foreclosure rates were up over 10% for subprime ARMs. Subprime fixed foreclosure rates were up over 5%. And I reacted almost immediately because I had never seen such percentage default rates when I was with Bank of America. And I was concerned because I knew that people we regulated, such as Bear and Lehman and people like that, had large subprime pool portfolios and things like that. And I talked to various people about this within the SEC, and the chairman told me to talk to Eric Seary and also Peter Ullman, who was the chief of staff, to talk to him about it. And so I took with me Con Hewitt, who was a former bank auditor and chief of superintendent of banks in California. He and I went in together, and I would say the first time we went in was November, December 2006, and then we talked to him again in January, then we talked to him again in February, March. And then by June 2007, those Bear Stearns funds went down, which were basically high-yield funds. And then by August of 2007, Bear Stearns reported this big loss due to the markdowns.
What was the SEC doing during that period in the summer of 2007, just staying in touch with Bear?
Well, the SEC was in on these investment bankers. I mean, it had a staff which basically went up and lived with them. And they would audit them, and they would look at records, and they would do this and do that. And they would find that they were meeting the Basel II net capital standard, which was the net capital standard that they had adopted, thinking that it was the most up-to-date, best standard there was, that they were well-capitalized with a meeting of Basel II, and on top of that, they had a $17 billion liquidity and so forth and so on. But I remained concerned, and I think Con remained concerned, because their leverage was so high. The leverage of these big investment banks was all over 30-1, whether your name is Goldman or Lehman or Merrill or Bear, whatever. Some were higher than others. Before Bear collapsed, it was almost 40-1. And what I mean leverage, I mean the ratio of assets to capital. You take your total assets on your balance sheet and you divide that by the amount of, let's say, shareholders' equity or Tier 1 capital. And you come up with a ratio, and that's what we call leverage, the leverage ratio. The defense of the investment banks was that you can't include the match book. Now, the match book is repos, basically. And so you have Hedge Fund X, who repos a bunch of securities to Bear Stearns. Okay, and so Bear Stearns buys all these treasuries and whatnot, and then has an obligation to resell them, and the hedge fund has to take them back in a day or 3 days or a week or a month or whatever. Then repo takes those same securities and sells them to Fidelity under a reverse repo, if you will, and Fidelity agrees to buy them but obligates Bear Stearns to buy them back within a certain amount of time. Basically, you can tell that what it really is a secured loan. A secured loan with a spread, where you make money on those. And their position was you match the left-hand repo with the right-hand repo, and that's a match book, and you don't count that for leverage. Well, the problem with that is severalfold. Number one, this is short-term credit. And the credit was getting shorter. That is to say, the term of these repos was getting shorter. And the second problem is while the securities covering these repos may be high-grade securities, if there's a lack of confidence in the rest of the firm, namely the subprime activities, Then all of a sudden, Fidelity will call up one afternoon and say, we don't want to repos with you anymore. And all of a sudden, your short-term lending pyramid collapses. And so the investment banks were excluding the match book from leverage. I mean, they claimed that the leverage ratio was down to 18 to 1 or 15 to 1 as a result of this. And, you know, I looked at that and I heard that. I never really totally agreed with it. But then we had a policy discussion, which I thought was a very good discussion. And that is, what is the role of the SEC in terms of telling these investment banks how to run their business?
Is this in the summer of 2007 that we're talking about still?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I would talk to Eric Seery, and I would talk to Matt Eichner, and Con Hewitt would be with me, and so forth. You know, you have to realize there were two people in the building who really had banking experience, me and Con, and that's it. Okay. But, I mean, it was good we were there, in a sense. But
yet, in principle, the SEC was supposed to be overseeing the investment banks.
Yes. But, I mean, we had private side experience. And even then, neither one of us had worked in an investment bank, so let's not get carried away with our experience. You know, we were working on bank banks. But nevertheless, bank banks had investment banks as part of them, so I guess you could say that we had experience.
Did you bring in the Federal Reserve or the controller of the currency?
No.
Discussions?
So the policy discussion went like this. We would say, shouldn't we be reducing the leverage of these entities? Just leverage means you're at risk. I mean, if you've got 40 to 1 leverage, it doesn't take a big loss of money before you're bankrupt, right? That's distinguished if you have 15 to 1, the difference. 15 to 1 was generally the net capital rule. By the way, people say that the consolidated supervised entity exempted them from the net capital rule. That's not entirely true. It was just a different net capital rule.
What was the ratio under the?
Well, obviously it was a ratio that allowed you to get up to 40 to 1.
Right.
Okay. You know, in that sense.
Yeah.
But it was a different rule, and it focused on liquidity and you know, having adequate emergency liquidity and things like that.
So as a result of this policy discussion, did you conclude that it might be possible to force them to reduce their leverage?
I had a discussion with Jim Eastman, who was my counsel, and we went through 15A2-1, and I determined that we had the legal authority to force them to reduce leverage. If we wanted to, we could. Chris Cox's position was, yeah, but they can they got in voluntarily and they can get out voluntarily. And that's true, except for one thing, is if they ask to get out, you can stall. They have to get our permission to get out, okay, but they can stall. We can sit there and futz around for a year or 2 years letting them out.
So it also sends a signal to the market if they try to get out, so they would pay a penalty in those.
So I never totally agreed with the principle that they can just get out. I mean, we could simply stall a thing. But the point I'm making is that the policy decision, it was a good one in the sense that Eric Seery's position was that our obligation is to protect customers' funds so that the brokerage customers will always get their money back. And you can do that by segregating their money in segregated accounts and so forth. And our business is not to tell them how to run their company, how to run their overall company. My position was, and I have to tell you, I mean, I was just as Republican as the rest of them, okay, I came in as that, was that even though I understand the hands-off, laissez-faire approach to the world, as a former banker, I didn't agree with that. That as a former banker, I believed in countervailing forces, and the countervailing force of intelligent regulation is an important thing to have in the American system, and that we should do that. But nevertheless, Eric did his argument, I did his argument, and Eric was head of the division, and that was his position. Now, you know, you can argue, if you want to, that Eric was right, in the sense that had we greatly reduced the capital, or the leverage of these entities, it might have led to its own market collapse problem. Do you see what I mean?
They would have got,
you know, it was too late, or something. On the other hand, that's the history of what happened. And I would say that by August or September of 2007, it was too late. At that point, the die was cast, pretty much.
But in the case of Bear Stearns, it didn't actually hit until about 8 months later, I guess, or
hit in March.
Later, in March.
March 14th.
Yep.
Of 2008.
Uh-huh. Let's talk a little bit about that period. I guess at the end of February, beginning of March, was there any sense that maybe the crisis had passed, or that, or was there still concern?
February, March of
2008. You were still at the SEC then, I believe.
Yeah, right.
So, yeah, okay. So this is when Bear Stearns actually collapsed in mid-March. Tell me a little bit about how that played out from the perspective of the SEC.
Well, it collapsed in a week.
Right.
Very fast. Mm-hmm. And it was as much a surprise to the SEC as it was to everybody else. And as the chairman described it, it was like a run on the bank. But when you have a bank built on short-term credit relationships, mm-hmm. once somebody calls up one afternoon and says, I'm not renewing the rollover of the credit, you can go bankrupt pretty fast. And that's what Basel II failed to pick up. It failed to pick up anything having to do with secured credit. It wasn't built into the Basel II calculations. Mm-hmm. It wasn't built into the mindset of the SEC Division of Trading Markets. Basically, while the SEC was certainly involved during that famous week, it couldn't be the decision maker because it didn't have a checkbook. The SEC has no checkbook. The Fed has a checkbook. The Treasury has a checkbook. And at the end of the day, the U.S. Treasury put up $52 billion to keep Bear Stearns alive. People say it's $25 billion. But they forget to count in the additional money that came out of the dealer facilitation network. But for that checkbook, Bear Stearns would not have been saved. And that's something the SEC doesn't have. So in a sense, the SEC was at the table as the regulator, but it wasn't in any way a decision maker because it could not facilitate the thing. What it could do is it could grant exemptions to permit the acquisition by J.P. Morgan to take place, and that sort of thing.
Tell me a little bit about how the SEC handled the public relations aspect of the crisis, particularly during this period with Bear Stearns. Was there a conscious decision to stay back from the spotlight? And because, as you said, they...
To the contrary, I thought that Chris was very much in the spotlight. I mean, there were several press releases that came out from the SEC during that period.
There was a little bit of criticism of his announcement on March.
At the end of the day, it's really hard to be a CEO. It really is. Mm-hmm. And Chris was CEO. And I was the advisor, or one of the advisors. And I was trying to advise Chris, caution regarding saying anything that says it's going to be all right. On the other hand, there's a natural tendency, whether your name is Greenspan or whoever, or Bernanke, to say everything's going to be all right. You see what I mean? You're there to kind of calm the markets.
Do you think that's what happened when Commissioner Cox said on March 11th that he had, quote, a good deal of comfort, unquote, about the capital reserves of the banks?
He did.
Yeah.
He did, because he thought that Basel II was a good standard, that they had $17 billion of liquidity, that they were well capitalized even though they had a high ratio. And so under all those standards that we were using at the SEC, he was right. Mm-hmm. The problem was it was the match book that brought him down. And the inability of Basel II to deal with short-term funding facilities that are secure. Mm-hmm. And when he explained this later, the chairman said, I admit, he says, Basel II missed that. I thought the chairman was very candid about what happened afterwards. But when he was making the statements on, what did you say, March 11th, that is true. But
Do you have any other thoughts about the SEC's role during the financial crisis? Or move on?
You're asking me.
Yes, if you had any other thoughts about it before we moved on.
Well, I was asked by the Hoover Institute at Stanford to participate in a conference called The Future of the Fed. And I'd say that conference was in the spring of 2009, is my guess. And they had all these luminaries on there. I don't know why I was there. George Shultz and Arthur Laffer and, you know, Myron Scholes and, you know, most of the leading economists or thinkers, you know, and they brought me in because I was a real-life former regulator.
The token regulator.
I thought they were going to throw darts at me. But they asked me to talk about the Bear Stearns crisis, and then they asked me to write a chapter of a book about it, which I did, and we went through this heavy editorial process. And that book is now on Amazon. It's called The Future of the Fed by the Hoover Institute, and my chapter is in there, along with a chapter by Shultz and all these other thinkers about where we go from here. And
okay. So did your experience at the SEC change any of your views about financial regulation or about the role of the organization?
Well, yes, it did, because I didn't come to the SEC with views on that subject. But over the somewhat less than 2 years I was there, I formed some very definite views on that subject, because it was a day and night operation. You know, I would live up there on Connecticut Avenue in the Kennedy Warren Apartments. I'd take the train down in the morning, and I'd work until midnight and take the train back. It was a full-time job for that period. And I came to the conclusion, number one, that we needed systemic regulation. Systemic regulation means that you're regulating the overall American economy from the standpoint of preventing the kind of crisis that occurred, which is a systemic crisis. Now, you got to be careful you don't overdo it, or you'll wind up with a Soviet-style managed economy. Okay. But we need to do better than we did. I came to the conclusion that the SEC is not set up to do that. And for the SEC, when it first announced the Consolidated Supervised Entity Program, it said that it would. Looked at systemic regulation, and the Inspector General criticized it for not doing an adequate job. My comment is the SEC never said it should do that, and number two, it doesn't have the facilities to do that. So, for example, the SEC does not have a total global picture of the repo market. It doesn't know who all the counterparties are. It doesn't know the total credit and debit and the net position of repos and so forth. Okay. Now, the Fed has a better idea of that than the SEC. So I became of the view that we needed an overall financial stability oversight council, which is in the Dodd-Frank regulation. And again, you could challenge me saying, I thought you were a Republican, you know, whatever, but I'm a realistic, practical one in the sense that I think that we need to instill confidence in investors and the public and so forth, and this overall council would be an answer to that. And as a matter of fact, some Republicans started filing bills. Susan Collins from Maine filed a bill calling for exactly that. And in that article, I reviewed her bill and gave it some kudos, you know.
Did you have an opportunity to provide any input into the regulation that came out of this period, into the Dodd-Frank Act or anything else?
Yeah, I talked to people on the Hill regarding it. I was out of the SEC by then.
Right.
And I had a one-year recusal period, so I was not allowed to talk to anybody in the SEC for a year. But I got involved in some of the Dodd-Frank stuff, regulatory stuff. The Financial Stability Oversight Council, it was not adopted in the form I would have wished. And if you read my article, you'll see the form I would have wished, which is very similar to what Susan Cullen proposed. The Financial Stability Oversight Council is basically a collection of regulators. All the major financial regulators are the members of the council. What does that remind you of? It reminds you of the president's working group. It's basically a reincarnation of the president's working group. And what group failed to pick up on the crisis? The president's working group. Okay? So it would seem to me that if you wanted to really give everybody confidence, you would have a majority of the commission be from the outside. You know, you'd have the likes of some pretty esteemed people out there, like Charles Boucher and people that are not regulators as such that are sitting on the council. The regulators are members of the council, but nevertheless, it's better than not having it. So we now have the Financial Stability Oversight Council, and we have enhanced supervisory regulation for big banks and things like that. And so, yeah, that's one conclusion I reached at the commission. But I do not believe the SEC is set up to be a systemic regulator.
Okay. All right, well, I think we've covered just about everything. Did you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Gosh, it was a great run at the commission. It was a night and day job. Nobody told me there was going to be a financial crisis.
Would you have signed up if you had known?
Until about a month after I got there.
Gosh.
I would do it again, and I believe in public service, and I would encourage anybody who has a chance to do it.
All right, Mike. Well, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
You're welcome.